Thank you for choosing KAXE this morning. We continue right now with more from Morning Edition from National Public Radio.
Good morning. Donald Trump will be president once again. He defeated Kamala Harris in a closely contested election by winning a number of key battleground states, including Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. What gave Trump the edge? We will speak with a pollster and our correspondents. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We also expect responses this hour from abroad, including the U.S.'s closest ally, the United Kingdom. Also, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has congratulated Trump on his win, but what does the victory mean for Ukraine? It is Wednesday, November 6th, the birthday of James Naismith, born in 1861 and known today as the inventor of basketball. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Former President Donald Trump will be the next president of the United States of America. The Associated Press declared his victory after calling the swing state of Wisconsin for him before dawn today. Trump has 277 electoral college votes so far. 270 are needed to clinch the victory. Vice President Kamala Harris has 224 electoral college votes. Trump didn't wait for the early morning call by the AP. NPR's Windsor Johnston reports he celebrated overnight in Florida with his family.
Thank you.
Donald Trump received a rousing applause from a crowd of supporters in West Palm Beach, where he declared victory shortly after the swing state of Pennsylvania was called.
It's a political victory that our country has never seen before, nothing like this. I want to thank the American people for the extraordinary honor of being elected your 47th president and your 45th president.
Vice President Kamala Harris is expected to address the nation later today. She and her supporters gathered at Howard University in Washington, D.C. last night to watch the returns. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu quickly congratulated Donald Trump on his victory today. NPR's Scott Newman reports from Tel Aviv. During Trump's first term, he strongly supported Netanyahu and Israel.
Netanyahu and Trump have enjoyed famously warm relations. In his first term, Trump moved the U.S. embassy in the country from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, a hugely symbolic step that reinforced U.S. backing for Israel. The Biden administration strongly supported Israel following last year's Hamas attack, but in recent months, relations have become increasingly frayed over Israel's handling of the war in Gaza. That strain was evident over the summer when Vice President Kamala Harris skipped Netanyahu's address to Congress. A recent poll found that nearly 65% of Israelis believe Trump would be better for Israeli interests than Harris. Scott Newman, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Republicans have flipped control away from Democrats in the next U.S. Senate. They'll now hold at least 52 seats. Incumbent Democrats lost in Ohio and Montana, and a Republican candidate won the open Senate seat in West Virginia. There are more Senate seats yet to be called. They're in Arizona, Maine, Michigan, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. Two incoming Democratic senators will become the first black women to represent their states. Delaware's Lisa Blunt Rochester and Maryland's Angela Also Brooks have won their races. In another first, Delaware Democrat Sarah McBride will become the first openly trans person to be elected to Congress. She'll serve in the House. This is NPR News. Voters in 10 states faced questions about abortion on their ballots. Voters in Florida, Nebraska, and South Dakota have chosen to keep their bans or limits on the procedure. Voters in Arizona, Colorado, Maryland, Missouri, Nevada, New York, and just now Montana have voted to protect abortion rights, including in their state constitutions. The services side of the U.S. economy showed continued strength in October, even as the manufacturing sector was struggling. NPR's Scott Horsley reports on a new survey of service industry managers.
The monthly survey shows new orders, business activity, and employment in the services sector all grew last month, despite uncertainty over the outcome of the presidential election and challenges posed by back-to-back hurricanes. That's in contrast to the smaller manufacturing sector, which has been hobbled by high interest rates and by the just-ended strike at Boeing. Retailers showed some of the strongest growth in the services sector, marking an encouraging start to the busy holiday shopping season. Construction companies also reported strong demand. Fallout from the short-lived dock worker strike at the beginning of October was limited. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Again, our top story. Former President Donald Trump has been elected the next president of the United States. The Associated Press made the call earlier this morning after the results from the swing state of Wisconsin gave Trump enough electoral college votes to declare victory. On Wall Street, in pre-market trading, stock futures are surging. Dow futures are up nearly 1,200 points, or about 3%. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
This election season, we want to make sure you're ready to vote with confidence. Hi, I'm Megan Buffington with KAXE News. Our election guide includes Northern Minnesota candidates in contested races, giving you direct access to their views. Our mission and our election coverage is to provide independent, fact-based reporting to help inform our communities. Visit KAXE.org to explore the guide and let KAXE News be your trusted source this election season.
Obstacles that nobody thought possible, and it is now clear that we've achieved the most incredible political thing. Look what happened. Is this crazy?
So you won't hear from the vice president tonight, but you will hear from her tomorrow. She will be back here tomorrow to address not only the HU family, not only to address her supporters, but to address the nation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Former President Trump did not wait for news organizations to call his win overnight before saying that he would also be the future president.
Many people have told me that God spared my life for a reason. And that reason was to save our country and to restore America to greatness.
Now, after that speech, the Associated Press did confirm Trump won Wisconsin, and with it went beyond 270 electoral votes. We heard the news break live on Morning Edition today. In addition to the presidency, Republicans will at least control the United States Senate. They have a majority. It's not clear how large. The House of Representatives remains too close to call. Democrats still hoping to take control there. NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith and NPR Susan Davis are here to talk through what it all means. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
And thanks for all your work through this campaign season. I really appreciate it. And let's talk about substance to the extent we can. Tamara Keith, how is Trump talking about a second term?
You know, he, on the campaign trail, has talked repeatedly about mass deportations. You had people waving signs that said mass deportations. deportations.
Yeah.
He has talked about that for people who are in the country illegally, but also people who are in the country legally, like the Haitians who are in Springfield, Ohio, for instance. I don't know practically how that's going to work. He hasn't detailed practically how a lot of his proposals are going to work, but certainly this is something that he promised and that many of his supporters are going to expect him to try to deliver on. He's talked a lot about high tariffs, raising tariffs on imported goods from all over the world. Economists will tell you that high tariffs are actually a tax on consumers, that it ends up raising consumer prices. He's also talked about tax cuts. He's talked recently about possibly revisiting the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. He said he had concepts of a plan, but Speaker Mike Johnson has talked about it happening more concretely. We don't know exactly how that would work either. In terms of foreign policy, Trump has long been antagonistic towards NATO, has said that the war in Ukraine needs to end and would end if he was president, would strongly back Netanyahu in Israel. In terms of other things, you know, personnel can be policy, and he has promised to include two high-profile people in his administration, RFK Jr., who he says he'll put in charge of healthcare in some way.
Tell him to go wild, was the quote from late in the campaign.
And yeah. RFK doesn't like vaccines also doesn't seem to like fluoride in water. So who knows? Elon Musk is another person. He has said that Elon Musk, the billionaire SpaceX founder and also man on Twitter and now owning Twitter, would be in charge of government efficiency.
Well, since you're mentioning personnel, let me talk about that. Susan Davis, I am thinking of a conversation that I had with a Republican who is generally supportive of Trump, but also concerned about who Trump would bring into government, who said, well, we don't have to worry that much because key positions have to be confirmed by the United States Senate. They will provide a check on that. That was what the person was thinking last summer. What do we make of that now that we know the election results?
Well, I think the bigger the majority, the better it is for Trump. At this hour, he has certain to have a 52-seat Republican Senate majority, but there's five races outstanding. This could climb as high as 54, 55. I talked to Republicans about this very fact just last week, and they said, look, the bigger the majority, the easier it will be to get someone like an RFK Jr. through the Senate. I think the nominees become the first order of business. And remember this, Steve, this time around, this is a much more pliant Congress. The Republican Party is deeply unified behind Donald Trump. There's no more Mitt Romneys. There's no more Liz Cheneys. And remember, Senate leader Mitch McConnell is stepping down from leadership, and the next Senate leader is almost certainly going to be much more of a Trump ally.
And I would say, take that also into positions that don't require confirmation. Trump, in his first administration, was surrounded by sort of traditional Republicans who wanted to constrain him or saw their job as being the adults in the room. Trump has learned from that. Trump and his closest allies have learned from that. He doesn't want adults in the room who are going to hold him back. He wants people who are going to allow him, enable him to enact the policies that he now believes he has a mandate to do. And if you look at the popular vote and you look at the Electoral College, he has a point.
We haven't even talked about that much, the economic program here. You did mention tariffs. A bit of news overnight, Dow futures, which point to where the stock market is going, way up, perhaps because people are excited about tax cuts, perhaps because they're just relieved not to have massive uncertainty after the election. But also bond interest shot up, meaning that people are anticipating this government to borrow a lot more money and possibly for inflation to come. You have a sense there, Susan Davis, of how much that these decisions could affect every part of American life.
I also think the most bankable thing that you can rely on right now is that the Trump tax cuts, the 2017 tax cuts, are pretty protected. Donald Trump not only wants them extended, but he wants to cut taxes further. Republicans on Capitol Hill are in lockstep behind that. They also, if they do take over the House, Steve, which is quite possible, though we won't probably know that for a couple of days, Republicans are going to have a tool in their pocket called reconciliation, which is what I call something boring but important. That means that they're going to be able to do a whole bunch of stuff in the Senate with a simple majority, which means that filibuster isn't going to stop Donald Trump in all things.
Good point. Democrats will still have the filibuster in some cases, but not in all if they can get to that point. NPR's Sue Davis and Tamara Keith, thanks to you both.
You're welcome.
We're going to go back to the politics for a few more minutes. The race was called neck and neck in those closing days. So how did this tight race shift toward Trump? We're going to talk with Chris Borick about this. He's the founder and director of the Institute of Public Opinion at Muhlenberg College. That's in Allentown, Pennsylvania. He's on the line with us now from Nazareth, which is in Northampton County. Good morning.
Good morning, Michelle.
So what was your big takeaway from the night?
Oh, just the sweeping nature of Trump's victory. You look internally in places like Pennsylvania, and his gains were very consistent across region, across demographics. It's hard to find really any clear bright spots for Harris in terms of outperforming Biden's numbers 4 years ago.
So when we spoke with you last month, you told us that the election outcome would be decided, quote unquote, in the margins. Is that still true?
I believe so, Michelle. If you look across the various demographics in the state, and you know, we're just kind of piecing through the exit polling. But if you look in regions, you look at the various categories of voters in the state, you'll see that it is modest gains, but consistent gains across across those various places and cohorts within the electorate in Pennsylvania. And that's, at the end of the day, certainly enough to claim victory.
Okay, you're mainly focusing on Pennsylvania. That's kind of where your work is focused. But you think you can extrapolate that across other places as well?
Yes, absolutely. If you're looking at the other swing states, the so-called blue wall in particular.
So the question is going to be, did the pollsters undercount or underrepresent any particular groups of voters? You know, in the last, really since the rise of President Trump, we've been talking about whether polling still works, right? Is polling still serving us? Is it still serving us?
Yeah, it's a great question, and one that I'm not sure we could fully answer this morning. I think if you look at the national averages in the polls at the various swing states, you're not going to see an enormous difference in the final outcomes in the presidential race. I think you'll see some more differences or larger differences in a number of those Senate races that were discussed, where polling seems to have undervalued Republican support. So, you know, as we've said in 2016 and 2020, there's going to be a lot of questions and reviews to see exactly where things might have gone wrong.
So speaking of talking about Pennsylvania, given Trump's success in places like Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, can those places still be considered a blue wall?
I don't think so. Two out of three elections, having those states not perform for Democrats, questions what their role in American politics is, and especially electoral college politics. Walls are supposed to, you know, block things from happening. For Democrats, that simply hasn't been the case.
And does it seem as though there is a realignment? This is something that the once and now future president talked about in his victory speech. He said that there is a great realignment. Is that true?
You know, we could debate, and yes, from a political science perspective, what makes a realignment. But I think there's substantial evidence that in the era of Trump, American politics have realigned. The electoral cohorts, the electoral coalitions are different. And so I think there's a case to be made that indeed there has been a realignment.
And what does that look like? Is it, I mean, we've talked a lot about the college, non-college divide that, you know, college-educated voters, particularly, you know, in the suburbs, but also sort of urban areas moving in the Democratic column, and less educated people moving to the Republican column, even union members moving to the Republican column. Is that what we're talking about, or is there something else going on here that we need to take a look at as briefly as you can?
I think that is the cornerstone, Michelle. We see that educational divide now mark American political coalitions, with Democrats certainly becoming a party of higher educated people with college educations, and the Republican Party, especially in presidential years, taking on the more working class elements that we see in the results last night.
And that does include people who are so-called racial minorities. We seem to see that too. Something to look at. That's Chris Bourque, the director of the Muhlenberg College Institute of Public Opinion. Professor Bourque, thanks so much for talking to us.
My pleasure.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. It is 6:19. You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on KAXE. We'll have more ahead from National Public Radio, plus lots of local election coverage starting at 6:30. Your hosts are Andrew DeZingo and Heidi Holton. We'll also be joined by our news team starting in the 7 o'clock hour. Programming on KAXE is supported in part by Jennifer Ivanza Insurance, an official MNsure partner. It is open enrollment season, and Jennifer Ivanza Insurance is here to support the Chisholm and Hibbing communities with health plan enrollment and guidance. More information available by calling 218-254-3422 or by visiting thenetworkmn.com. And support comes from Timberlake Lodge in Grand Rapids, offering an endless soup and salad bar for lunch and burgers and hand-cut steaks for dinner online at timberlakelodgehotel.com. A mix of clouds and sun today, highs in the mid to upper 40s, winds from the west around 5 miles per hour. Lows tonight in the upper 20s, and tomorrow sunny, highs in the mid to upper 40s, and breezy west winds. We receive support from Atchison Tire in Grand Rapids, providing service and offering tire brands like Bridgestone, Firestone, and Toyo, serving the area since 1916. More at AtchisonTire.com. Support also comes from the Grassroots Concert Series presenting Charlie Wagner Friday, November 22nd at 7:30 p.m. at the Livewell Nightclub and Coffee Bar in Nisswa. Doors open at 6:30. More information at GrassrootsConcerts.org.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Sattva, committed to making handcrafted mattresses that help lull people to sleep and keep them sleeping soundly. More information is at SAATVA.com/NPR. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at Progressive.com/careers. From Midi Health, committed to providing a supported path to symptom relief for women in perimenopause and menopause, offering personalized virtual care. Learn more at joinmidi.com. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Stephen Skeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. With Donald Trump's return to the White House, Ukrainians are faced with losing the U.S. as their biggest single ally. Trump has said he will end crucial aid to the country. He also claims he will end the war in 24 hours, although he has not explained how. For reaction in Ukraine, we're going to go to NPR's Joanna Kakissis in Kyiv. Joanna, good morning.
Good morning, Michelle.
So what are you hearing this morning from Kyiv?
So Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has congratulated Trump, and writing on social media, Zelensky said he and Trump had a, quote, great meeting in September, and that he appreciates what he calls Trump's peace through strength approach in global affairs. Recently, Zelensky has grown quite frustrated with President Biden's White House, saying their approach is overly cautious and encourages Russia to be more of a bully. But what was not said here is that Trump has professed admiration for Russian President Vladimir Putin, who is the reason Ukraine is at war in the first place.
Well, to that point, are Ukrainians concerned that Trump will accommodate Russia when it comes time for peace negotiations?
Yes, they're very concerned. I've spoken to lots of people this morning, including 53-year-old Oksana Tsupi. She's a trader in Kyiv, and she said she expects the U.S. will force Ukraine to give up territories now occupied by Russia. Here she is now. So she's saying we are so small in this world of big politics, and unfortunately, our lives are worth nothing.
Hmm. Did anyone you spoke with see a path forward?
Yeah, some people do. I'm in touch with several soldiers who are on the front line, and they say they're not going to give up just because of a leadership change in the U.S. This morning, we spoke to 35-year-old Andriy. He gave only his first name according to military protocol. And Andriy said Trump's election doesn't change how he views this war. He's saying, look, if we have to adapt, we will do it. Our people have already shown so much resilience, so we will rely on our strength and our forces.
Okay, so tell us a bit more about both of those things. What are Ukraine's strengths right now, and what are their challenges right now?
So the biggest challenges are on the eastern front line right now. Russian forces are advancing, and now Ukraine has confirmed that thousands of North Korean soldiers have joined the Russians. And with Trump in the White House, NATO membership for Ukraine may not happen in time to save the Ukrainians. Trump is not supportive of the security alliance, which Ukraine desperately needs for long-term protection against Russia.
Does Ukraine have any other assets that they can draw on right now to counteract this?
Well, I mean, they could turn to Europe. They do have strong relationships with the new NATO Secretary General and other countries in the European Union. The European Union leadership is very strongly behind Ukraine. But again, it's not clear that the European Union can compensate for the loss of the U.S. As an ally if that actually happens.
That is NPR's Joanna Kakissis in Kyiv. Joanna, thank you.
You're welcome.
And now let's turn to a frequent guest of the program, historian and Russia expert Sergei Radchenko of Johns Hopkins University. Welcome back, sir.
Good morning.
I want to begin with the premise of the interview we just heard, that Ukraine is, quote, faced with losing the United States as a crucial ally. In talking with some Republican supporters of former President Trump, President-elect Trump, I guess we should say, in Congress, they will sometimes make the opposite argument and say, yeah, he wants to bring peace to Russia and Ukraine, but he will do it by pressuring Russia. Is there any evidence to support that viewpoint of what's going on here?
Well, so far we haven't had any evidence that would suggest that Trump is going to pressure Russia. And how? I mean, if he wanted to do that, perhaps he could provide more military aid to Ukraine, and that would be a great starting point. I'm sure Zelensky would be looking forward to that. But what we heard from Trump so far is that he wants to strike a deal. And that's something I think that Putin also wants. But Putin will make his demands. He wants sanctions relief. He wants recognition of the territories that he had annexed in the course of this war in Ukraine. And he wants guarantees of NATO's non-enlargement into Ukraine. Now, that last bit is probably the easiest to secure from the United States, which I don't see actually welcoming Ukraine into NATO. That's been a sticking point. But those other things, you know, that's hard. That's hard. And we'll have to see whether Trump will agree to that. But I'm sure Putin is very thrilled. They're excited by this.
How do you understand Trump's attitude toward NATO? He criticized NATO allies, as did his predecessor, President Obama, for not spending enough on defense, but has done it in a certain way that's made people feel that he wants to get out of NATO.
Well, he hasn't. You know, in some ways, actually, his criticism has been useful for NATO because we have had a situation where NATO allies are not spending or were not spending even 2% of their GDP on defense. But what has happened over the last, some years, and now especially since the Russian invasion of Ukraine, is that NATO member states have generally been meeting the 2% target, and in some cases, and especially in Eastern Europe, have been exceeding it. So that actually, this critical attitude by Trump has actually helped force the Eastern Europeans come around to understanding that they're responsible, and well, not just Eastern European, but all of Europeans are responsible for their security, much more so than they thought they were in the past. And I think if that pressure continues, I think maybe the Europeans will finally come around to recognize that they need to spend much more on defense.
Is there a real risk that Europeans might end up on their own with the United States just decoupling?
I think the risk of that, but of course we saw that discussion earlier during the first Trump presidency, and ultimately Trump never pulled out of NATO, although a lot of predictions were to the effect that he would. Obviously we'll have to see what happens this time, but I think there's going to be a lot more pressure on the Europeans to come around and invest much more into their defense. I think that's the right thing to do, especially given the challenges that the United States is facing in Asia.
Got about 20 seconds. I want to ask about one other thing. In the middle of Election Day, there were bomb threats in multiple places, at polling places, and the FBI blamed Russia for some of them. In about 15 seconds, what do you make of that?
I mean, there's no clear that Russia is out to create chaos, not least in the U.S. electoral process. So I'm not surprised by those allegations on the part of the FBI.
Sergei Radchenko at Johns Hopkins University, thanks so much for your insights, as always.
Thank you for having me.
This is NPR News.
Election night is behind us, but some races have yet to be called. We'll bring fact-based reporting to help you make sense of what's to come, plus the latest from the Harris and Trump campaigns and updates on ballot initiatives around the country and races that'll help decide the balance of power in the House and Senate. That's all on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear election coverage on a national level coming up at 4 o'clock on All Things Considered with your local host, Jennifer Barr. It is 6:29. I'm Heidi Holton.
And I'm Andrew DeZingle.
Yes, and Andrew's joining me in the KAXE studios in Grand Rapids. We had a big night at the station, the news team up, getting all kinds of results. We'll be doling out results from the local elections around the region, talking to folks throughout, getting some analysis, so stay tuned throughout the morning.
Yeah, it's exciting to be here in the Grand Rapids studio.
Yeah, there we go. So we're expecting some areas of fog early this morning, then partly sunny, highs 46 to 49, west winds around 5, cloudy tonight with lows 28 to 32, and partly sunny for tomorrow, highs in the mid to upper 40s, and looking like 50s on Friday with some sunny skies, which I think everyone would like, a little get rid of the gray out there, right?
Mm-hmm. And we receive support from ICTV. Stay tuned. Stay connected with ICTV. Learn more at watchictv.org. And we receive support from Dragonfly Coffee, located in Central Square Mall in Grand Rapids, featuring a scratch bakery and offering espresso, bubble tea, and more. Empowering inclusion and community through employment, special order pricing, and more at drinkdragonfly.com.
Take a look at KAXE.org. Lots of information about races from around our region, political races, as our news team put it together. Like we said, they'll be joining us throughout the morning. Also, some analysis from Minnesota Reformer, from Aaron Brown, from the Brainerd Dispatch. So stay tuned. So hundreds of local races were decided yesterday by Northern Minnesota voters. There were incumbents that were toppled. First-time candidates emerged as victors and ballot questions passed and failed, and Minnesotans turned out in large numbers to have their voices heard.
And some results from the county commissioner races in Beltrami County District 2, Joe Gould won, the incumbent. In Beltrami District 3, Scott Winger, and Beltrami District 4, Tim Sumner was victorious. And then in Crow Wing County District 5, Jamie Lee was the winner. And in Itasca, District 4, Burl Ives, the incumbent but passed away in September, was victorious. This means there will be a special election.
Also, some of the House races. We also invite you to text 218-326-1234. We've got a lot of results in front of us, but if you're looking for information, just let us know. In the Minnesota House District 2A, that covers Lake of the Woods County, most of Beltrami County, and the northern portion of Clearwater County. There was no incumbent in that race. The winner was Bedell Duran, the Republican candidate, and he was facing Reed Olson. It was a tight race, 51% for Bedell and 47% for Reed Olson. We also have been watching House District 2B. That includes Bagley, Manoman, White Earth, Bina, Castlake, and Black Duck. There was an incumbent there, Matt Bliss, and he did win. He's the Republican. And in the Minnesota House race 3A, that includes Cook, Lake, Kuchiching, portions of Itasca and St. Louis counties. And the incumbent was Republican Roger Scraba, and he kept his seat.
In the congressional district races, Congressional District 7, Michelle Fischbach, the Republican incumbent, won. And in Congressional District 8, Pete Stauber was also the incumbent.
Coming up, we'll be bringing you more election results, more analysis, more national news. Stay tuned. This is Wednesday, November 6th.
I know now that I can't make good
How I wish I could. Back and put me where you stood. Nothing's really something now, the whole thing should. It serves to suffer, make a hole in my foot. And I hope you as I fill my book. Oh, what a waste of wood. Nothing's really happened like I thought it would. Such a violent spree. But maybe you can still make a man from me. Here on Space Side Key. With what's left of me. As you live and breathe. I really know now what had hold on me.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. If you are just joining us, the Associated Press has called the White House for President-elect Donald Trump. We are hearing from him elsewhere on the program. Meanwhile, there was a big election watch party here in Washington, D.C. last night, but the hundreds of people who attended were not Americans. They were election officials and experts from more than 60 countries across the globe. NPR's Frank Langfitt tells us more.
Socorro Inting came all the way from the Philippines, where she works as a national election commissioner. After visiting polling stations yesterday in Northern Virginia and Washington, D.C., she said she was struck by how much faith poll workers have in voters.
They trust the voters because the voters can just come, say their name, no need to prove their identity. They can even register during election day.
That's not the case in the Philippines, where, among other things, corruption is a big problem.
Well, you know, vote buying is rampant in our country.
President-elect Donald Trump and many Republican officials have falsely claimed election fraud is widespread in the U.S. But foreign election officials I spoke with at last night's party don't believe that, including Ernesto Ferdinand P. Maceda Jr., another commissioner from the Philippines. He says the U.S. has done a good job managing elections across such a huge landmass and large population.
This is the top of the line. This is the benchmark. If there's any talk about irregularity, it's negligible.
Election officials were attending a program organized by the International Foundation for Electoral Systems, a private nonprofit. The program featured seminars on everything from voting technology to spotting deepfakes. Anthony Banbury runs the foundation. Promotes democracy around the world.
What I hope is that our international guests are able to learn some of the good aspects of U.S. electoral politics and electoral administration, and that they can take it home.
Attendees came from all over. K Kenya, Taiwan, Belarus, Honduras. Olga Ivasovska came from Ukraine, where she works for a nonprofit that defends political rights. Ivasovska looks forward to national elections in her homeland, but that's impossible right now because of the war.
Ukrainians believe that the good guys are fighting and defending the state on the front line. That's why they will not have any possibility to vote or to be a candidate. But without them, the elections will not be free and fair.
In addition, Russian troops control a big chunk of Ukrainian territory, making it a no-go zone for voting. Most election officials at last night's party were circumspect about revealing a preference for either major candidate in the U.S. presidential race, except for an Argentinian legislator who wore a MAGA hat and posed for photos with a cardboard cutout of Trump. But a fellow Argentinian legislator, Manuel Correll, found reasons to support both candidates.
Our president, Milei, has very close relation with Trump.
Javier Milei is Argentina's right-wing president, but Correll prefers Harris's support for international organizations over Trump's America First approach.
Trump, he's questioning all the values that rule the world.
Give me an example.
He don't believe in nations that share same values like NATO, the UN.
Correll and everyone else were watching the election closely because, as another attendee at last night's party put it, the winner will affect the entire world. Frank Langford, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
It is 6:40. You're tuned into the Wednesday morning show. This is KAXE. I'm Heidi Holton with
Andrew DeZingle.
That's him, and we are
it's
here for you.
It's a crossover episode.
It's always a little, it kind of is. It's like Scooby-Doo when the Harlem Globetrotters came on board.
I'm the Harlem Globetrotters?
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm Scooby. There we go.
Row.
It's, yes. It is, thank you, Andrew. I needed that. Election coverage will continue in the local level, and like we just heard from National Public Radio, on the national level. We'll be continue to bring you that this morning. Lots of folks probably didn't get a lot of sleep, including our news team. They're going to be joining us throughout the morning, catching a few hours here and there because they were up all night. We've got full results available for you at KAXE.org. Let's look at the weather around the region. 39 right now in Grand Rapids. Hibbing 34, Bemidji 36, so is Aiken. Brainerd has some fog with 29 degrees, and it looks like Embarrass at 28, Bedette reporting 35 degrees.
And Bemidji Parks and Recreation is putting on a community puzzle swap at the historic Carnegie Library now through November 9th. You can drop off up to 10 gently used and complete puzzles and then receive a voucher. They'll be open Monday through Friday, 8:30 a.m. until 4 p.m., and Saturday, 9 a.m. until noon.
We're going to be bringing you analysis of the races from northern Minnesota, the election coverage. We'll be talking to people like Patrick Kulikan from Minnesota Reformer, Aaron Brown, Teresa Bork from Brainerd Dispatch, and we'll also have our reporters. Larissa Donovan will be telling us about northwestern Minnesota and kind of give us some more information, and Andrew and I will bring you more results as the morning goes on.
Looking at county commissioner races in County Carlton County, District 1, Sarah Plant-Buse was victorious. In Carlton County Commissioner Race District 5, Dan Reed was the winner. In Cass County, Rusty Lilliquest from District 3 was the winner. No current incumbent, but Lilliquest was previously on the board. In Clearwater County Commissioner District 2, Brian Ramsrud, and Clearwater County District 4, Bruce Emmel, was victorious, and County Commissioner race in Cook for District 4, Ann Sullivan, was the winner.
Some of the Minnesota House races in our region, the 3B race, that included rural St. Louis County, excluding the Duluth area, the incumbent won, the Republican, Natalie Zelenznikar, beat Mark Munger. Very close race there, though, 50.25% for Zelenznikar and Munger at 49.65%. Also for Minnesota House 4B, portions of Clay and Becker counties, including Detroit Lakes, the incumbent Republican Jim Joy won that seat. And Minnesota House District 5B, Staples-Motley area, 6A, portions of Cass, Itasca, and Crow Wing counties, and that includes cities like Grand Rapids, Emily, and Crosby. The incumbent, Ben Davis, Republican, won over Earl Butenoff. And Minnesota House District 6B, covering Baxter, Nisswa, and most of Brainerd. Josh Heinzman, the incumbent, won pretty handily in that race over Emily LeClaire, and there was an independent candidate in that race as well.
And in the Minnesota statewide race and the constitutional amendment, the Environmental and Natural Resources Trust Fund renewal was approved at 77.48% yes vote.
If you have a question, you can send it our way. Text us this morning. If you just want to send some good thoughts, we'd love to hear from you this morning. 218-326-1234. Coming up tomorrow night, you can be mesmerized with comedy hypnotist Randy Andrews. That's at the Kiesler Wellness Center. Reserve your seat by visiting kieslerwellnesscenter.org. Proceeds go towards mental health crisis services. Have you ever been hypnotized?
No, I don't think it would work. Like,
Have you ever been asked if you've been hypnotized?
No, I think they can see me in the crowd of just like, this guy is just going to fight tooth and nail to not be hypnotized to try and show me.
Oh my gosh, I think that would be kind of fun. Who knows what something like, we may need something like that in our weeks. We're also asking people, you talked about the event going on with the puzzles. Are you a puzzle guy?
I wish I was a puzzle guy. I just don't have like a good spot to do puzzles and then just leave it without like, oh, I need that table.
Yeah. Yeah. I wish I was a puzzle guy too. It's just, I've done a few and I've enjoyed them. It's just not a regular thing for me.
In COVID times,
yeah,
I was into puzzles.
Nice.
Me and my roommate would just work on this puzzle while listening to records and stuff. Those good times.
Yes. I know. Isn't it weird to think of all those different things we sort of did during COVID times? Don't forget, we've got outcomes of the races in northern Minnesota, political outcomes for yesterday's elections. You can find it at KAXC.org. We'll also be bringing you music throughout the morning. We heard from Bon Iver earlier this morning. And coming up next from National Public Radio, Evelyn Perez-Verdia, founder of We Are Maz, about the role of Latino voters in the 2024 election. You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
The task before us will not be easy, but I will bring every ounce of energy, spirit, and fight that I have in my soul to the job that you've entrusted to me.
Donald Trump addressing supporters last night in Florida, claiming victory in his bid to return to the nation's highest office. Now, this came before key states had reported their results, but it is now confirmed. The Associated Press has now called the race in his favor. He will become only the second president in U.S. history to leave the White House and then return. So let's take a look at the supporters who got him there. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben and Tamara Keith are here in the studio with us. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Danielle, let me start with you. You've been to many, many rallies and campaign events with Trump over the last year. Talk to us about who his most enthusiastic supporters are and have been.
Sure, yeah. I mean, the base of his support, and this is not going to be a surprise, is older and white people. When you look at his rallies, that is who they are full of. And these are people who have stuck with him from the beginning, in addition to that. I've talked to countless numbers of rally attendees, and it is I've asked every one of them, or near every one of them, how long have you supported him? It is the rare person I have spoken to who has said, oh, I'm a convert. Overwhelmingly, they've told me I've been with him since 2015. So even though Trump picked up some new voters last night, clearly, the base of support is just the base of support that's always been. Now, one other thing that you could see at rallies is young men. You did not see small cadres, or at least many small cadres of young women showing up together. But young men, you saw a lot of them coming to those rallies and really, really getting pumped for everything the former president said.
Tam, let's go to you now. Tam, Keith,
yeah.
Where Trump went for motivating his core group, Harris was focused on building an ideological coalition. She was relying on people like, former Vice President Dick Cheney and his daughter,
Representative, former Representative Liz Cheney, who had been a member of the Republican leadership. They actually campaigned together, but that does not appear to have been enough.
Yeah, she was trying to stitch together an anti-Trump coalition that included a lot of strange bedfellows, people from the far left and then people like the Cheneys. And it was always a little bit of a risky bid, right? Trump was trying to get more people who supported him to turn out. Harris was trying to get people whose identity, people who long identified as Republicans, to do something that was not in line with their longstanding identity about who they were.
And what was that about? Like, why?
In part, that was because they were seeing the erosion among Democratic base voters that clearly came through and actually came through, I think, stronger for Trump than they were expecting. But they knew that they might lose Latino men, for instance. They knew that they could lose young men. And they knew that black men might stay home. They knew that they were not going to do as well with men as President Biden did when he won. And so they were searching for some other well of voters, and they were searching in the suburbs.
So, Danielle, talk about that, if you would. Now, certainly some groups of black voters and Latino voters have always voted Republican,
sure,
you know, for lots of reasons. But what about that erosion that Tam was sort of talking about? How did that happen? And where did that happen? And why?
Well, short version is we have, at the very least, seen it among men. When I'm looking at these exit poll numbers, now you want to be careful when you're talking about these smaller subgroups because there are huge margins of error on there. But it really does look like black women and Latinas really stuck with the Democratic Party, and black men and Latinos, especially the Latino men there, really swung towards Trump.
I'm hearing the feminine, the masculine there in the way
yes.
you're using the Spanish.
Yeah.
I mean, men are from Mars, women are from Venus. That's this election.
But Tam, will you talk a little bit about that? You started talking about this earlier, but what about Harris's performance with white women, with younger voters, with groups that Biden had overperformed with in 2020 in order to win? Did Harris fall short there?
Yeah, you know, I was looking at certain, in Wisconsin, in fact, certain suburban districts that Harris needed to perform better in for them to, you know, meet their numbers. And the reality is that she really didn't outperform Biden in these key counties. She just didn't. And that their theory of the case falls apart there.
I'd like to make a couple of observations and see what you think about them, having covered the campaign all the way through, about people who supported Trump. Our colleague Mara Liasson made an observation the other day that Trump was not looking to expand his base. He was not looking to reach out. He was looking to find more voters who already agreed with him to begin with. And there are always millions of voters out there that don't vote regularly, have never voted at all, and you reach out to more of them. But when I interviewed some of those voters over the past year, I felt like there were a lot of people who were kind of choose-your-own-adventure Trump voters. They would pick the parts of Trump that they like. And of the many, many things that he said, if there was something wild or controversial or noxious that he said, they would, well, he's never really going to do that. That was my impression of a lot of Trump supporters.
That's always been the case.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you and Mara, by my eyes, are both right on that. I mean, when you're talking about Trump not trying to persuade and just trying to drill down deeper into his base and wider, yeah, I mean, in the last few weeks, when we have seen him not being careful with his message, to put it mildly, and not moderating, not reaching across the aisle, anything like that. Yeah, that is what he has been doing. And people who want to ignore parts of his message, they'll ignore the parts that they want to ignore, and they will latch onto the parts they want to latch onto. For example, his talk about the economy, his talk about mass deportations, whatever they like. And there's a lot about him that a lot of people do like. That's what they will go with.
And if he talks about RFK and fluoride, either you like that or you don't like that,
you can ignore
it. For me, the way.
Yeah. Real quick, though, Danielle, Trump will be the oldest person ever to take the oath of office in January, but we also have our first millennial in the White House. The vice president is sort of J.D. Vance, and that's also another interesting sort of dichotomy. What do you make of it?
Most definitely. I mean, J.D. Vance is also a proponent of a lot of thinking about the new right. He is profoundly online. So he is very much like Donald Trump, but he is not. And so I am very curious what influence, if any, he has on the Trump presidency, or if he is just going to fall in line behind whatever Trump says.
Real quick, Tam. does any agenda? What's left for the Biden-Harris team? What can they do?
They are going to try to lock in their policy wins, but it's really hard to lock that in when you lose the presidency and you lose the Senate.
That is Tamara Keith and Daniel Kurtzleben, who've spent many, many hours on the campaign trail following these candidates. And thank you both so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Heidi Holton.
I'm Andrew DeZingle.
6:54. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Wednesday Morning Show. We're getting national election updates from Morning Edition, and we're bringing you Northern Minnesota election updates. Our news team up through the night bringing us great coverage you can find at KAXE.org. They'll be joining us for analysis and other folks helping us understand what happened with the vote yesterday.
Looking at some election results, the Nisswa mayor race, Jennifer Carnahan was victorious, the former chair of the state Republican Party, and was plagued by a number of scandals.
Mm. Minnesota House race 7A, that includes southeast Itasca, western St. Louis, and northern Aiken counties. Spencer Igoe won that race. He's the Republican incumbent over Aaron Schnauzer. And Minnesota House race 7B, there was no incumbent in this race. It's in South Central St. Louis, Eastern Iron Range, and Virginia and Chisholm counties or areas. And that one was won by the Republican Cal Warwas. He won by 56% over Lori Janitopoulos, the Democratic candidate, at 43%.
In Hibbing, the Hibbing Regional Public Safety Center was approved with a yes vote of 55.48%. 5.5% sales tax to finance new regionally public safety center, house fire, EMS, and police. The tax will last up to 20 years or until amount is received up to $19.6 million project costs plus cost of bonds. And the International Falls mayor race, Sharon Ball won with 33.33% of the vote. And in Black Duck City Questions, 5.5% sales tax questions and the library rehabilitation was at 53% yes vote.
We're also going to be covering some of the municipal races around our region, and that includes in Grand Rapids. And there were two seats up for election. Rick Blake won along with Dan Mertes. They won over Joe Burns. The mayor race, Tasha Connolly, once again mayor, she ran unopposed. And we'll be telling you more about the ISD 318 school board race. The top three won in this. It was Tom Gustafson and Ashley Goodman and Dave Cowan. Brian Vroman lost by just 1.6%. That was quite a lot of candidates in that race for school board. We're seeing school boards become increasingly popular around our region.
You know, my dad was a school board member for a long time.
Was he?
Yeah.
Do you remember, did he have to campaign and everything? Do you remember that as a
kid? I don't remember him campaigning at all.
Okay. I think things have maybe changed a little bit over time.
And then he stepped down from being a school board after I graduated.
Oh, okay.
So I got to hug him on graduation day, which was nice.
That's good. Coming up, we're going to have some music for you. We'll have news headlines from National Public Radio. Here's the weather. We're expecting partly sunny skies, the highs 46 to 49. West winds around 5 and cloudy tonight, lows 28 to 32. Looking partly sunny tomorrow with highs in the mid to upper 40s. We would like to thank our business supporters of KEXE, and that includes?
That includes Coldwell Banker Northwoods Realty, offering decades of experience to guide your real estate journey from buying or selling to land or lakeshore. Be moved by Coldwell Banker Northwoods Realty. More information at coldwellbankernorthwoods.com. And we receive support from the Green Heron Bed and Breakfast, a four-season B&B on Pokegama Lake, featuring home-cooked meals and all the amenities needed for a complete family vacation. More information at greenheronbnb.com. Loving the lake quietly.
Do you want to be a could be someone.